Hello and welcome to the next episode of Lost in Criterion. I'm John Patrick Owatari Dorgan, and with me, as always, is a man who knows exactly how to use a stiletto comb.
I am the Adam Glass. And,
well, those are switchblade combs. Shit. It doesn't matter.
It's okay. It's okay. We'll fix it in post. We won't.
We won't. That's, it's better when I make mistakes good, anyway, because it's already bad.
Yeah.
And it's funnier when it's worse.
I did, for a time, think switchblade combs were so cool. It'd be that and Tootsie Rolls. Were every
did you also have greased back
every
hair?
Arcade,
I'm just asking. I just need
every,
to know.
Every arcade opportunity. Never greased back hair. I just had greasy hair. I don't know if you remember, but in high school, I got a haircut once every 18 months, whether I needed it or not.
I, Adam, and, do not... Yeah. I have completely replaced every memory I have of you with you now.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
I don't have a good working brain.
I'm just ecstatic that you remember my face now well enough to...
Well, let's be clear here.
It.
I do it when I see you. Otherwise, you are just a weird blur.
just a mash of color.
That
sometimes.
Is slightly taller than me.
We have a guest this week. You've probably heard him giggling. It's Stephen Goldmeyer. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. How's it going?
Good, good.
Thank you
happy
for having
to have
me.
You here.
Yeah.
Stephen originally was going to be on our last 3 weeks of episodes, but unfortunately timing didn't work out. So instead, we got the one lawyer we know to be on the 12 Angry Men episode. that's awesome.
It's actually
not
an accurate description of the number of lawyers we know. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah.
One of the lawyers
know
we know is one of the most famously ridiculous episodes we've ever made.
Always a pleasure to have you, Stephen.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
We'll get to the movie in a second, but first, I want to talk about our Patreon real quick. It's patreon.com/lostincriterion. Over there, for just $1 a month, you can help keep us going and help us pay some server bills, and you get some nice rewards, primarily bonus content. We do a non-Criterion film over there every month, and somehow... Well, this week's movie on the main podcast that we're going to talk about today is directed by Sidney Lumet. I was just sharing before we started recording that somehow in our bonus episode, Sidney Lumet is the one director we've watched the most of. This is not on purpose.
The Sidney Lumet cast.
We have just accidentally watched three different Sidney Lumet movies over the course of the history of the bonus episodes, and I don't think we've ever repeated a director at all in the bonus episodes.
My understanding is that Sidney Lumet directed Kazam, so that's, you know, part of it. Yeah.
Yes.
The
yes,
lore.
Yes, that's
but
number four.
Not
number four.
The fabled Shazam. Let's be clear here.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. If you want to hear us talk about more Sidney Lumet movies, you can support us on Patreon for just $1 a month and get that whole back catalog. For a little bit extra, though, $5 a month for folks who can afford it and help keep us going, we'd like to thank them on air. And... Stephen, you're one of our $5 supporters. Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're being asked on air. Thanked. I don't fucking know. Well, there's something wrong.
I'm being
I should probably just stop,
live
guys.
And in person.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh. Well, thank you to Stephen, and thank you so much to our other $5 supporters, Eric Coronado, Chris Otto, and Andrew Jarrett. A bit above that $5 mark, we do something pretty dang special. Pat makes a piece of art based on one of the movies we watched recently. I get that printed up on a postcard and write a little personalized thank you note to our $10 and above supporters. And we also like to thank them on air. Thank you so much to Adam Speakerman, Nina Bojnak, Jason Westaver, Patrick Yako, and Tracy McGrath, our $10 and above supporters. If you want to see those postcards without committing that $10 mark, head over to redbubble.com. Search for Lost in Criterion there. Our store will come up and you can see past postcards and you can buy them. As postcards, as greeting cards, as stickers, as magnets, some as t-shirts, at least one as a phone case. I really just go crazy sometimes as I'm clicking buttons, scrolling through the list of offerable material. It's fun. Big thanks to everybody who has purchased anything off that Redbubble over the years. Big thanks to everybody who supported us on Patreon. And thank you also for listening. This week, as I said, we're talking about a Sidney Lumet film, 12 Angry Men, from 1957. This one's interesting because Criterion's weird sometimes, right?
I refuse to believe that. That's impossible.
A lot of a lot of times.
Just reflecting on my first outing on this podcast being Armageddon. Yeah. Criterion Collection's weird sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. A while back, we did a box set called the Golden Age of Television. And the Golden Age of Television was full of teleplays.
Yes.
Among them was Patterns, written by Rod Serling, and Marty, written by Paddy Chayefsky, which are two of the most famous teleplays from, respectively, 1955 and 1953. Patterns in 1955, Marty in 1953. They redefined television drama in so many ways. And we talked a lot about that during that box set. 1954's big redefining teleplay was the original 12 Angry Men. That was not in the box set. It is a bonus feature on the DVD release of this film.
That nobody could get.
that I got.
Oh, well,
but,
good for you.
But it was hard to come by. But it's not out of print or anything. It's just timing did
so
not,
many people
allow.
Wanted to rent it from the Columbus Metropolitan Library System.
That is actually true. I forget where it came from, but it was way outside the city through the interlibrary loan. The Golden Age of Television was spine number 495, and it seems like it would be pretty logical to have thrown the original 12 Angry Men onto that box set, but it wasn't. And instead, now nearly 100 spine numbers later, we get the 12 Angry Men film, which I'm very happy. It's like, you know, as I said in the intro, I think Sidley Lumet, there should be more Sidley Lumet in the Criterion Collection.
It is actually shocking how many we've been able to do as bonuses, because
as bonus
basically
episodes.
There's not, like, wait, yeah. Dog Day Afternoon is the only one that was in the Criterion Collection?
No. No, Failsafe is the only one that was in the Criterion Collection.
Was Dog Day Afternoon
Dog Day
a bonus,
Afternoon.
Too?
Hmm. Dog Day Afternoon was a bonus.
Shit, man. Okay, sure.
Yeah, and Failsafe we won't watch in the Criterion Collection for years and years and years.
I refuse. You can't.
The only one... Yeah. The only Lumet we've actually watched as a Criterion... in the Criterion Collection so far
Armageddon.
Is the Fugitive kind. Oh. No, no, Sidley Lumet did not direct Armageddon. He should have, but it would have been a very different movie. No, The Fugitive Kind was a Marlon Brando starring Tennessee Williams adaptation that we watched about 2 years ago, a little less
movie.
Than 2 years ago.
Oh, I remember it now. Okay, yeah. Boy, that would be, that's, yeah, yeah, okay.
It was very Tennessee Williams, so there's just not, Lumet is an American director. I mean, we complain a lot about the Criterion Collection favoring American and British and Western directors, Europe more at large, Japan to a lesser extent. But Sidley Lumet is an American director who I really like. It took us so long to watch Network as a bonus episode because I just assumed Network was already in the Criterion Collection.
My theory on this is maybe Sidney Lumet movies are just really hard gets. Like, they still sell.
Maybe.
Mm. Yeah, maybe.
That might be fair.
Like,
it's interesting
just wants
to me
to keep
that
the rights because it sells well. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe, it's interesting maybe. To me that there's like that Tennessee Williams connection, right? Because when I think of Tennessee Williams, I think of yelling and sweating.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And like that definitely is a big theme for this movie also, even though it isn't a Tennessee Williams thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this, the original and the screenplay for this one were both written by a guy named Reginald Rose. Rose is sort of interesting in the pantheon with Paddy Chayefsky and Serling as the big writers of these sorts of television dramas.
Mm.
But unlike Chayefsky, he never pivoted to film. And unlike Serling, he never pivoted to hosting his own show. He kept writing these for a while. And then in the early 60s, he became the creator and main writer for a television show called The Defenders, which was about father and son defense attorneys who primarily took up civil rights cases free speech cases, that sort of thing. Seems like an interesting show. I've never seen an episode of it. I've also seen it sort of described as the prototypical courtroom drama series. So probably shows I've seen owe a lot to The Defenders without me knowing it. But
yeah.
So please.
Well, I always have a little bit of caution for anything that sort of insists that it's depicting defenders, right? Like,
even
this movie, right, like kind of has a pretty bad attitude about court-appointed defenders, public defenders, and maybe defense attorneys in general, which is
sure
like so typical of these sort of like, you know, liberal takes on criminal justice stuff. So it's interesting to hear that he maybe has a whole show, but I would be curious what the take is.
Yeah.
Well, good news is Marvel remade it on Netflix a few years ago. So
that is much easier to come by. So Rose wrote this, and then the progeny of this is kind of interesting too. We talked about it, when we did the Golden Age of Television box set. Our bonus episode that month were film adaptations of some of the film, some of the teleplays we'd watched for the box set. Marty was the first one, and the turnaround on Marty was very fast. Marty as a teleplay was in 1953. The Marty film came out in 1955. And then Patterns, the big Serling one, the film version, the original teleplay version was 55, and the film version, I think, was within a year. It was a very quick turnaround as well. 56, in fact, yes. So off the strength of those two adaptations, Henry Fonda thought he should make one too, and really liked 12 Angry Men, and also it was the one of the big three.
The only one left.
Yeah, so Henry Fonda had access producer. Fonda and Lumet both waived their fees to do this, though I don't know what Lumet's film would have. I don't want to know what Lumet's salary would have been like at the time. This is his first. This is the first feature film, but Fonda obviously is the big star here, and he waived his salary and acted as a producer, which got it made on the cheap, something like $300,000, which they barely made back.
Really? That seems
extremely high for what is actually happening. Like, you know, that must have just been like overhead of, you know, paying caterers
right.
stuff. Because that, it's just one room, man. How does it?
Yeah,
but all those rain effects. Somebody had to sit there and sprinkle water down the side of the building the whole time.
Yeah.
There are at least 14 on-screen speaking parts, so there is that.
Yeah,
but it premiered in one theater for 2 weeks.
Jeez,
did not make enough to justify opening the theater, and then went on to become a certified classic. When it came out, this was certainly not as interesting to people as Marty and Patterns had been. And, you know, it's a single room drama about a murder that has already taken place. So all of the drama is interpersonal. And I can certainly understand an audience not reacting to it well. But it seems like critics loved it, but no one even came to see it. It wasn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm really curious. Like, unfortunately, Wikipedia doesn't seem to tell the whole story, obviously. But like, I'm really curious about the interleaving time between those two things, because you've got its debut in one theater. Critics like it, but that's not enough, or maybe isn't in time to even like get it shown more for people to even see it, because it seems like they like. Basically shut it down after 2 weeks, right, or whatever. But but then like it becomes a classic, and like this is one of those fascinating ones, because that's such a short run and such a limited run of the film. I'm really, I'd love, there's probably, somebody's probably written a book about it, frankly, but like how you go to like enough people having seen it, it becomes a classic. You know what I mean? Because
right. Yeah,
that run is so small and limited. That it's like 1,000 people see the movie total?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's
maybe.
And so it's like, that's crazy. How you go from that to enough people to have even seen it to like spread the word about it.
Yeah. I mean, the only sort of telling line in the Wikipedia article, right, and it also then cites to some other featurette on a DVD or something, was that it didn't really find its option until it aired on television. So it is
right.
It is interesting to see, like, 12 Angry Men, you know, popular, well-received television thing. They have this
yeah.
this movie made, and it's kind of lukewarm reception. And then everybody's like, oh, but, you know, actually, this would be great if it were on TV.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, that seems to be what it was. Yeah. Well, the interesting aspect about those TV dramas and Marty and patterns among them and everything in that box set we talked about with that box set was that they were singular events.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're live TV. Was, right, aren't they?
They're live TV, and the ability to record them is sketchy at best.
Yeah. Well,
you're
I mean, yeah,
a
we talked about the idea
at a television screen.
The system
yeah.
of literally pointing a film camera at a TV is what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So they don't.
Right.
There's no way to repeat them except to restage them, and a couple did get restaged as just future episodes of the TV
yeah.
series.
Hmm.
And then a few get made as movies, and the first two that got made as movies really, really well received. Marty has always been viewed. I can't remember the initial reaction to Patterns, but it was well enough that somebody thought 12 Angry Men was going to be good too.
That's so interesting.
Well, that, yeah.
It seems to suggest that, you know, like they're basically the only role of this movie is like, you know, that like they did like a Hamilton cast recording album, right? Because
yeah.
everybody's like,
yeah.
oh, Hamilton is so great and everybody who's ever seen it loves it, but most people haven't seen it. But then they do
yeah.
like a cast recording and the Disney movie, and it's like now more people can see it. But it is just the same thing. It is not meant to be
yeah.
like a new, it's just, okay, it was so popular, like, but the technology is not available for everyone to see it. So let's, it's interesting to think about that this movie is not even maybe not best thought of as like a film that like came from a TV thing, and more as like a way of getting the TV thing in front of more people, right?
Absolutely.
Well,
interesting.
I would argue that I agree completely, except for with the caveat that it's probably more like Mamma Mia in the sense that like it's a big play thing that like this they did, because Mamma Mia is a stage play, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they
well,
go,
so is Hamilton.
Oh,
but
right. No, I understand.
But you're
that,
right.
But Mamma Mia, the stage yeah. play does not have the same cast as the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also,
I've never seen
and
Mamma
the movie,
Mia the stage play. But
the movie also, like, you know, like the camera movements are different. It's so, in other words, the Hamilton
right.
movie is like still on a stage. It's still meant right. Whereas Mamma Mia is like adapted into, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
oh,
right.
And I think that's more like what the, yeah. It's
yeah.
the same basic
yeah.
idea of like, oh, people want to see this shit. And like, we
right.
don't have VCRs, so
yeah.
what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Plus,
yeah.
they added
yeah.
Some ABBA songs to 12 Angry Men. So
right.
You know.
Right, right, right.
Yes.
We should probably have mentioned that at the top.
Yeah.
The score's pretty different.
It's weird that didn't come up, but yeah.
The big musical numbers are
yeah.
are pretty distracting. But
I'm trying to imagine 12 Angry Men, but with musical breaks, is wild.
Mm,
yeah.
Just one of them's
yeah.
on the table in the middle, like doing a dance number.
I ended up watching the teleplay version, and it was a cleaned up version of the original podcast.
Yeah.
It was a cleaned up version of the original broadcast, which is, again, weird that exists and it wasn't on the Golden Age of Television DVD. Obviously, the only reason I can think of that Criterion wanted to have put that on the Golden Age of Television was if they already had the 12 Angry Men disc in the works, but given how
that's a
quickly,
long time, yeah. Well, or if they
that's
just
a
had
really
an
long lead time.
Like for example, like
yeah.
you know, like there's a world where this all makes sense, which is like okay,
yeah.
well, it's owned by MGM, right? And And one could imagine a world where MGM knows that their whatever sort of run of whichever production house they have making it now is about to run out in a year, in like 2 years or whatever. And they say, and Criterion goes to him and says, hey, like, we would love to make a special Criterion version. And, you know, MGM says, well, yeah, okay, that sounds great, in 2 years. Like, when this, whatever deal we have producing this one runs out or whatever.
Yeah, but 100 spines in 2011 is more than 2 years.
I know, that's true. That's true. That's, I mean, like, that's just like 5 years or something. There's no, they're doing what, like 12 a year at that? How many were they doing at that time? We figured it out a long time ago.
It is right on the cusp of them increasing, but they really don't start to increase production until 2013, right around when we started the podcast.
Right.
So yeah, they're maybe a dozen a year. Prior to that,
well, they're just more playing their cards. They're like, you know, we're going to get 12 Angry Men someday.
Yeah, at least that's my understanding. I'm sure there are listeners who could correct me on that. But
it's also maybe wondering when the restoration of the 12 Angry Men teleplay was conducted, when the actual restoration happened.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also possible that happened much later, or even at the behest of Criterion Collection, which does happen sometimes. So.
That's fair. That's fair.
I've headed down just a tiny little rabbit hole and discovered that there is a 12 Angry Men musical that came out 2 years ago.
Dear God.
So, yeah.
That doesn't surprise me.
Me either.
I am definitely...
The tone on that would be so upsetting.
You know, jazzy, I guess.
I am definitely picturing...
Like, you know, the... Yeah.
I am definitely picturing chimpanzee to chimpanzee levels of music here, but... But yeah, so I watched the teleplay version, and there's a lot of differences, some minor, some pretty big. Minor ones, the kid's 19 instead of 18, as he is in the film. A very interesting minor one that's maybe not so minor is that when Juror 10 goes on his racist rant, and the stockbroker, number 4, I think, is the one who tells him, we've heard you, now sit down and stop talking. In the teleplay version, he says, now be quiet or I'll split your skull.
Whoa. Okay.
Which changes Ten's motivations for shutting up, right? Because he's been physically threatened instead of just embarrassed. It's rearranged a bit as far as when things are introduced and what comes up and what lines are said where, but mostly it's the same. It is a half hour longer.
Well, the real movie.
And most of the real movie is a half hour longer. And most of that is the introduction of backstory. So no one's jobs are mentioned in the teleplay version. Mm. The thing with juror number three's son. Is not in the teleplay.
Hmm.
And the ending is the big difference. Again, you know, it's not a huge difference in that Juror 3 is still the last holdout. But ultimately, all he shouts is, all right. And that's taken by the rest of them to be in agreement. And they funnel out to go back to court to present. And then number 3 and number 8 are the last two to leave the room. And number 3 picks up the knife and
stabs.
Holds it to number 8's chest for a second.
Oh.
He doesn't
oh
dab.
Goodness.
No. holds it to number 8's chest for a second. And then they both walk out and the camera pans back through the empty room. Hmm. And that's the end of the teleplay. Wow. So that's a much
that's
more
a
ambiguous
different
vibe
ending to the end there. Yeah,
yeah.
That's
right. Yeah. So and obviously, as Stephen alluded to with the Mamma Mia, it is shot differently. You know, despite being still a closed room, very small set.
What with having four walls,
Lumet is much more interested in individual characters' faces, whereas. The original director is more broad strokes.
We watched a lot of stuff about how these teleplays are produced and stuff.
Like, oh, yeah.
Close-ups on people's faces in those teleplays was not really a thing you could coordinate very well. because you're like literally moving around live TV cameras, and you've got a certain number of them to work with, and you're going to have to get that thing pretty freaking close to get a close up on a face, and then you got to get it out of the way real fast for whatever the next shot is. Right? It's just like it's just not a thing you can do really. I mean, yeah, you've got telephotography and stuff, but like then all you're going to run the risk of is that like you've got a really weird shaky shot because it's a, again it's a live stage. Like it's just you can't just can't do that kind of the movie's got so much more room for like choreographing everything.
Right. Franklin Schaffner is the director of the teleplay version. And, well, choreography is an interesting point because they were so, you had to choreograph everything.
Everybody
right?
had to know down exactly to the camera where they were going to be at all times. Yeah.
And you had a 3-week running time to make sure that happened correctly. And you had 3 cameras that had to be out of each other's shot while you were doing
all of this. Right, exactly. There's certain things you just can't do because you couldn't do because it just would be too complicated. You'd run the risk of like...
Right.
causing yourself a problem. We watched some really interesting documentaries at that time about that from that stuff, and I found that stuff really fascinating because there were all those like horror stories that they told, some of them where it was like, because remember there was a, like interviews with some of the like remaining studio actors who were alive or whatever, I can't remember anymore, but they were talking about like times where like things got switched the last minute, and instead of having 3 weeks they had like 3 days or whatever, and it's like a nightmare.
Yeah, so obviously the film versions also give you more time to think about what you're doing and do it approach it differently, right? Not to say that the original was not done well, it's just done under different conditions, and much tighter conditions. But Sidney Lumet got his start directing those sorts of teleplays, so he had a mind for that sort of thing already, and actually credits it as the reason he's very famous for being able to come in under budget and on time for his films, his theatrical films, is because he had instilled him in organizational structure. It's even before he was doing the teleplays, he was doing 2 half-hour series a week. And that's still live television. He's doing a full hour of live television a week and having to keep 2 shows in his head on that same sort of timeline where I've got the script for 3 weeks from now, the costumes for 2 weeks from now are being finished, it's being cast, and we've got to do rehearsals for this week's episode, and I'm recording this week's episode, we're doing this week's next week's episode, or anyway, the timeline's crazy. And he managed to do it. So he credits that as the reason he's so good at what he does. And he is good at what he does. Rose is a guy who sort of, Reginald Rose the writer, is a guy who sort of flies under the radar, politically, I guess is what I mean. Mm. We're in the 50s, right? He's never, Serling is accused. Rose is never accused. But Rose is doing a lot of similar work to what Serling is doing. Interesting enough, Sidney Lumet, his name comes up. He is falsely accused because he had not, at least at the time, ever been a communist. Lumet seems to have reacted from being falsely put in front of the McCarthy hearings by deciding that he's going to start hiring blacklisted directors or blacklisted writers. So... Rose is not one of them, but the other series that he did for CBS had blacklisted writers writing under assumed names. Look at Lumet's career. He is someone who is interested in pushing political boundaries throughout. Dog Day Afternoon is... a very interesting movie for the time period it comes out in politically.
Yeah. I mean, well, Dog Day Afternoon's an interesting movie now. I mean, when you consider the sort of information about the world when you think about the world we live in right now, it's sort of like, wow, Dog Day Afternoon is not so much a like a thing of the past. Yeah.
Was this received as very politically subversive or interesting at the time?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't get that vibe. I don't get a politically subversive vibe from it, honestly.
Right. Well, I think you might know this better than I would, but the legal history of this, and when we exist in 57 with this version, 54 with the teleplay version, and what rights are guaranteed to the accused,
mm-hmm.
Are the jurors' opinions ultimately liberal within the time period? You know, we come in and 11 guys are already, yeah, he's obviously guilty and we're not going to think anymore about it. That is the story of the play. And that, you know, it's pushing against that status quo, period.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to a certain extent, I would think yes, but I really don't know.
Yeah. I don't know enough about where things were politically at the time, but certainly just like looking at it from, you know, with a sort of retroactive lens, there are a lot of ways to read some very, you know, maybe even more subversive kind of viewpoints into it. But I do think that it probably does, you know, like the founding fathers were saying stuff like, you know, better one guilty guy go free than, you know, whatever.
Right.
100 guilty people go free than one innocent person gets put in jail. That's like, so, you know, in other words, I do think this looks so much like a statement of a lot of very sort of commonly held beliefs about our legal system. I mean, the fact of the matter is that they just show the kid at the beginning and it's like, maybe he's identified as sort of ethnic in some way, but
right.
At most Italian, you know what I mean? Like he's not a black person. It's, you know, it's not, you know, and the whole like quote unquote racist thing is easily read as being about poor people. Right. And like people, right. It's, they don't talk about race at all in this movie. And so I don't know, this isn't making any sort of really strong statements about anti-racism or anything like that. It seems a little more, I think, milk toasty, but maybe for the time, though, even the things it was doing were pretty subversive.
Yeah.
But I also think that when you read political analysis of this movie, it doesn't say that it really is about the legal system. I think a lot of people read it as being about McCarthyism and things like that.
Right.
Right? Which is like, you know, anyway, I'd be curious how people would have perceived it at the time. Yeah.
Well, we're in a time period where any perception of being too far left gets quelled pretty quick.
Right.
By executives, by government censors, by all sorts of people.
Yeah.
There is actually in some of the extras it's brought up, Reginald Rose wrote another television show called The Thunder on Sycamore Street. I'm pretty sure it was a television show. It might have been a teleplay.
Mm.
But his inspiration for that was a news story about an African-American family moving into a predominantly white suburb.
Mm.
And that's what Rose wrote, was an adaptation of that true life happening. However, by the time it goes to air, the script has been reworked, and it is not an African-American family, but a family of an ex-convict.
Mm-hmm.
A white ex-convict.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And according to the bonus feature, and the talking head on that, whose name I don't recall, as far as Rose was concerned, prejudice is prejudice. And and he was writing against prejudice.
Right. You sort of get that feeling from this movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. That is not to say necessarily that Reginald Rose was not perturbed or angry that his script was being changed.
Sure, sure.
But that he resigned himself in the end to still doing the show rather than pushing back against the executives who did not want to make a show starring an African-American family, which adds a whole new meta commentary to whatever Rose was trying to say about prejudice, right? That his executives were like, well, we can't make a show with a black family. That won't play mm-hmm. in the South. So let's do it this other way. And Rose can view that as metaphor if he wants, but it's still also an example.
Right.
Well, when you combine that with the fact that, like, well, no one is ever going to know that it was originally, like, generally speaking, the mass audience is not going to know it was originally supposed to be about a black family. It doesn't, unfortunately, the sort of meta commentary element of it won't really exist for anybody except for Rose.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean?
Like, and I think Rose's Rose's adaptability, his willingness to make those concessions, is probably one of the reasons no one ever accuses him of being a communist, because Serling was a guy who stood by what he said. Rose seems like a guy who was willing to back up.
Well, and also, like, looking at the sort of the actual movie, right? Like, so if you kind of looking at the history of McCarthyism, it would be easy to sort of see this more as a retrospective than anything, like an immediately following. Like, so by 1957, McCarthyism's mostly winding down. It's pretty much gone. Lots of things legally have happened and stuff that make it just not tenable anymore. And so it's pretty easy to see, like, maybe this is like a almost sort of a like victory lap by like the film version, at least. Obviously, the TV version is a different thing.
Yeah. That, I mean, that is absolutely the vibe, is sort of like a liberal victory lap, right? Of like, you know, like, this is, look how great our system can be when the average Joe stand, you know, like, it definitely has that very, like, you know, optimistic, you know, it has an optimistic ending, right? That people, you know, if only we just talk with facts and logic, we could convince even the biggest, like, dickheads on the planet to come around to our side. We can stop fascists with conversation, you know?
Right.
It's very optimistic, which is the only knock against it, as far as I'm concerned, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you know,
yeah, I mean, politically, it just doesn't have it does not have a meaty message that, like, in the sense that okay, flip that. Here's what I'm going to say. It has exactly the kind of message that is, air quotes, meaty, for your, like, high school English teacher or whatever, or civics teacher to, like, put on the TV and be like, all right, guys, we're going to watch 12 Angry Men, and, like, I want you all to pay really good, like, this is how the American system is, but, you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Where, like, if you are inclined to be, like, dislocating your shoulder in the efforts to pat yourself on the back, this movie will really help you in that effort. It'll, you know, it because, like, it is a sort of liberal wet dream of a film in that way.
Yeah. Uncommentated on in anything I can find, but your the optimism of this film, I think there's one small detail that really is exemplary of it. There's a women's restroom in the jury room.
I know, it's amazing. It's, like, so funny. Like, okay, so I watched this with my family. Well, all but my youngest son, who was like, I do not want to watch this. Why are you trying to show me things in black and white? I watched this with both my wife, with Rumi and John, and the immediate comments was, Rumi says, wait, why aren't there any women? John goes, why aren't there any black people? I was like, man. Well, guys, let me introduce you to America.
Yeah. It's, I can't argue that, you know, it is sort of a liberal victory lap. Is it early enough, or is it too early for a victory lap? I mean, obviously, yes, but, even in the minds of the people making this, is it too early for a victory lap? maybe.
I mean, I think it is specifically probably meant to be a victory lap with regards to McCarthyism, specifically.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right,
it's like
it is
a victory lap about that.
Right. And it's alluding to prejudice without naming those prejudices.
Right.
On the one hand, allows for different productions to handle that differently.
Sure.
And race certainly plays a much bigger factor in the 1997 Friedkin version.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, we're generally, just boiled down to class and allusions to those people. The neighbor woman being one of them. And what them means is left ambiguous enough that,
I mean, legitimately, had you not seen the defendant in the first first minute of the movie, I think the entire audience would make pretty broad assumptions about who the defendant is. I think in some ways you're meant to. I will say this. I do think in many ways you are meant to forget that as an audience member in some ways.
Maybe.
I'm saying like they're trying to like. I don't mean in like a. I don't mean in a way where like they're. How do I explain this? I don't think you're like forget, but I think you're supposed to start like maybe start processing it in a slightly different way as the movie goes on. As an audience member, you're supposed to start going like, oh, I know what this is supposed to be an analogy for, kind of thing in your head. Like, oh, they couldn't put a black person in a film. Because, you know, like legitimately 1957, I don't know what that would have been like. I don't know what the rules would have been. I don't know what people would have, like, who knows? I don't know what the Hays Code is. It could have some weird clause about like black people aren't allowed to be found innocent of crimes in American cinema.
But
you know what I mean? It's there were certainly time, man.
Yeah.
There were certainly laws on the books that were pretty close to that.
Yeah.
As far as reality goes.
Right. And so I'm just saying that like I do think in some ways, and again, I still completely agree this is a liberal victory lap. It is in that way like hyper optimistic about the American system and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, I do think maybe as an audience, the way we're supposed to listen to those diatribes and stuff is very is meant, I think you're supposed to, as an audience member, start to like get the point.
Yeah. Well, I think it also leaves the ambiguity up so that audience members of an oppressed minority can view themselves in that narrative as the system being able to defend them when the system is acting at its best. And I'm reminded then of
in
Kings
a way
I've
that
been to
absolutely
a mountaintop
the system
speech.
Will not act for them. Let's
right,
be very
right,
clear.
Right, 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 right.
It's selling
ten,
them a bill
10 years
of goods
later,
100%. But
yeah. Right. 10 years later, Martin Luther King is repeatedly saying, all we're asking is America to be true to what it says on paper. And this film is a reminder of what the paper says, right? And what America can be if we are true to what it says on paper. But we're definitely still solidly in a time then and now where those ideals are not being lived up to, certainly. But also this film is one where where it's not quite true to what it says on paper, because some things happen in this jury room that should have been a mistrial.
That's correct.
Pretty clearly. Yes.
It happens pretty immediately. Within very early in deliberations, someone suggests, I wanted to do an experiment of my own, and that my ears went up like, well, better not tell anybody about that, otherwise this guy's gonna get a new trial and go to the electric chair.
Yeah, that is actually one of the key differences I noticed in the endings of the two versions I watched. The teleplay does end with juror number eight leaving with the knife. After number three threatens him with it, he folds it up and hands it to him, or holds it threateningly, then folds it up and hands it to him.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas our film version ends with the non-evidential knife still sticking into the table in the jury room.
But Adam, it's such a pointed image. We can't just throw it away for legal facts. That's not reasonable.
Sure is going to raise some questions.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of things that they were doing in that jury room, which would absolutely get the case thrown out if anybody ever found out that they were doing it. And if I were on the, if this were a case where they came back with a guilty verdict, it'd be very, very easy to get it reversed on appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's not legally sound, but it doesn't have to be, I guess, for what it is.
It's a drama nonetheless.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about the law, but is there any legal drama that's ever been on TV that was in any way reflective of the actual law? I have to assume no.
Yeah, I mean, it's just boring. The problem is it's just very boring. To get it this exciting, you really do have to, a lot of people's, prejudices and the revelations and stuff that happen, they just wouldn't, ideally, in a courtroom, that stuff just isn't happening. It's just not that interesting. Right. It shouldn't be that surprising. Everybody already knows all the facts that are going to come out before they come out. And the jury, if something's not presented in evidence, the jury is not supposed to be thinking about it. And the idea that a jury is sitting there and saying, they didn't present this to us, so that means something, is just it's so antithetical to the way that courtrooms are supposed to work. But it'd be way less interesting if as soon as one of them said, I went out to see if I could find one of these knives, and someone else said, well, you can't do that. What else are we going to talk about? I'm going to walk across the room and see how long it takes. Well, you can't do that. Over. What else are we going to talk about?
Yeah.
It would be a lot less interesting, certainly.
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah. The fact that, he's number eight's done his own investigation.
Here's the best part about 12 Angry Men. Yeah. Okay. I want to throw this out here because out of curiosity, I was like, oh, I wonder, presumably people have made lists of all the mistrial worthy things in 12 Angry Men. So I typed in 12 Angry Men mistrial. The best part about this is not the fact that those lists exist, which of course they do, is the fact that every single one of them has essentially the same title, which is 12 Angry Men. Did the movie get it wrong or something like that? And they're all as though even you're as though you couldn't, I don't know how to explain it, as though you couldn't figure out just in general that this is probably not how things work. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think even your average, purely layman audience, which we are, me and Adam are,
yes.
That's what I'm trying to say, is going to realize you probably can't do this shit. This doesn't seem to track. I mean, that's the thing the first time I watched the movie was this is probably not. But then again, how many episodes of Law and Order have I watched? I've accepted a lot of legal fictions over the years.
I know.
Right. I'm reminded of a Twitter feed I ran across one time that was every episode of Columbo and why the defendant would have gotten off in the end.
Sure. Columbo's a great show, but Columbo just wildly breaks the law all the way. I just watched the wine cellar episode where Columbo steals a bottle of wine from the guy's wine cellar, feeds it to him to prove that he's guilty.
Neat.
Yeah, I mean,
creative police work.
You have to accept this. It's a really interesting episode. Otherwise, and that show entirely thrived on what kind of awesome stars can we put in this 1 hour, 1.5 hour drama and make them act insane.
Yeah. In the end, I think this, legal dramas in general, you are right, Pat, to point out, are about using a legal setting in order to create the drama, right? But the actual drama does not come from necessarily the legal rules or what's going to happen in the courtroom. It comes from the interpersonal dramas and things like that. And I think that I'll notice that I really did say the only knock on this movie that I have is it's sort of is a little too optimistic. I'm not knocking it for its flaws.
Because that's not what it's for, right?
Yeah. And you're right that that's just incredibly, you know, that's just, it comes with the territory of becoming, you know, trained and spending years working in a field that you just can't watch fictional depictions of your field anymore. And
exactly. We've watched enough movies about education where I'm like, please fucking shoot me in the head right now.
Or, you know, like you'll hear people like talking about for medical dramas on TV, and people are like, oh, the high intensity of all these medical dramas, and medical people are like, well, the way that everybody's kind of just like goofing around in Scrubs is like more accurate to an actual medical workplace. Yeah. You know, because it's like, that's in the end, this doesn't feel realistic to me of like what jury rooms are probably like. Did you watch what is the name of that show that just came out? It's a comedy that it might just be called The Juror or something like that.
I know what you're talking about. I did not watch it.
So
but it's the premise is that it's a all of the jurors are actors,
correct,
except for one person.
So that's actually recent. Okay, I was wondering about that because
within the last
one of the
couple
YouTube
years,
channels I follow talked about it because they did a comparison between that and in the thing that Shatner did in like the 90s where he like pranked the whole town and compared like the spirit of the thing and talking about those like the idea of like roping normal people into your fictions.
Right. But, and I am like really interested in that idea, but I will say that just like on the question of like accuracy in depictions of things, that show and like the like weird dramas about like where they're going to order food from, not dramas but sort of the comedic like getting the food orders right and like somebody like smells bad because they're like not showering or whatever, that stuff feels much more accurate to me of like what a jury room would be like. Like the idea that at no point anybody was like, it stinks in here is like, to me that's a pretty glaring omission of the reality of what it would be like to be in that room.
To be fair, the film shows and doesn't tell us about how much.
Yeah, I mean everybody. 100%. Yeah, that's true. That's true. It definitely does show and not tell. And that room smells bad, real bad.
Yeah,
and everybody knows. Like that was the other thing that my family marveled about. That wasn't the drama of the story, which is like, why are they so sweaty? Like, what's going on here? It's like, well,
it's super hot and there's no AC.
New York with no AC in the summer, and like they just didn't have the cultural frame of reference to understand that like what that's actually going to be like.
Right. That's actually my least favorite part of this movie is how on the nose the turn is, because the storm breaks, which means they have to turn the lights on, which means the fan now works. So we have the storm, we have the light of an idea, and we have the wind of change, all back to back. As we get the 6-6 vote, and it's a little much in the writing. It's a hat on a hat.
Yeah, I mean you're right, but nonetheless, I find it all very very compelling. I prefer to use the broken towel dispenser in the men's restroom as my hallmark of what. Where the things are.
Yes, as far as the metaphors go,
that's funny.
I was reminded talking about education movies that we've watched and critiqued, and obviously Law with you, Stephen. When we watched My Dinner with Andre, one of the things I was sure to point out was the weird ways the waiter acts.
We've done this with anthropology too, from my perspective as well, which
that's really
is
funny.
Always bad. It's always extremely
and I've
bad.
I've certainly never watched a podcasting film that I thought was good.
God, you know
that's for other.
I mean, legitimate question: has one been made? There has to have been one made, right?
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
Yes. Right?
And it's obviously bad, but like I just thinking to myself, certainly that stone has not been left unturned.
Do you ever think about like, you know, 50, 60, 70 years from now, people are going to be like, oh, well, this was the quintessential podcast film. Like, you know.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Oh,
there
boy.
Was like a really resurgence in interest in podcasting. And then, that's right. This is like, the Stone Cold Classic, 100% certified fresh podcasting movie or whatever.
God, that's a nightmare. God, how would you? I mean, you would have to do like... Here's the thing. There are certain jobs that, you know, obviously anything that involves real life is going to require dramatization, right? It's going to require, like, amping up. But, like, one can assume that certain jobs have moments in them that are almost filmic in their nature, right?
Yeah.
Certainly every director seems to think that directing is one of those jobs. At least every French director does. But it's just the idea of like how boring podcasting at its core is, how much like jazzing up it would need. I guess it's probably Jury Room level. Like in the sense of like, well, this is a very, very boring thing / place.
Well, that's
the amount of juice you're going to have to inject into it to make it interesting.
But that's the other thing about, you know, like doing the reality format as a way to handle something like a Jury Room is that they just film, you know, 8 to 10 hours more a day. And that results in so little, you know, that's like interesting or usable. You know, that's the other thing is 12 Angry Men, right? Is like, you know, all killer, no filler. It's all drama. They're not really leaving out any moments. It's almost real time, essentially. Yep. Whereas like in these like other depictions of juries, there's just a lot of time where you're doing nothing. Like, you know, they didn't, by 7, they hadn't had their sandwiches delivered to the room yet to take a break, you know? Every single non like jury related conversation they have in 12 Angry Men is like a metaphor for something that's going on in the room.
Right.
Yep.
You know? Anyway, yeah, there's no room for just like sort of lighthearted, like characterization-y stuff to happen in this movie. It really is just like, yeah.
Right.
They're definitely going drama. For pure tight drama, right? Like,
That's right.
I mean, even like as you pointed out, the goofy stuff that people do is, meant to like give you sort of character information and like metaphors for like what's going on and stuff.
Yeah, or reveal something about how they make choices or what their prejudices are.
Right, right.
You know, which, you know, in a lot of ways, that's what's great about this movie is it really is just like so precise, you know.
Well, I think it's very telling that I could show it to my family that knows nothing of like jury duty just only came into existence in Japan the last 10 years.
Mm.
Could show this film to my family and they're like they were invested. They were watching really like closely. Yeah. It's like, well, this is a very old film. In black and white about a thing that doesn't even that only started happening in this
concept.
Country like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like it's just such a tight drama that they're just completely engaged. Like the stakes are set like by the movie itself. It explains immediately from the beginning like, "Oh, this kid's going to die if they find him guilty." Straight up.
Right.
That's the answer. Like they say it out loud at the beginning just to make it very clear even if you're like an audience in another country like what the deal is.
It's so effective, right? And it's not, you know, it's not like you say, it's very straightforward. It's not, it feels weird to say it's not high art. It really is kind of populist art. Like it just tells you everything and anybody can sort of get into it and appreciate it. Which I think it probably is, you know, part of why it stood the test of time so well and why it's so popular. It is really very good sort of populist art. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what's so impressive about the teleplays themselves are that they're not just art, but they're technical prowess, right? Everyone's got to be on their A game every week, right?
Which is a fact that is largely invisible to the audience watching. Like we understand this high technical art, but like the audience is like, "Yep, I watched that movie on TV this week, and then I'm going to watch a different one on the other TV, one of the other three channels tomorrow." Like, and it's like, this is just a thing you're consuming that requires a massive amount of energy, effort, and like technical skill.
Right.
But like, the audience doesn't know that. they're like, whatever. These guys do this all the time. It's no big deal. And like,
I think all the time about, I got really into the movie Children of Men at some point. And there's like a very dramatic scene that's happening in a car where somebody's like bleeding out and everybody's screaming, right? And I watched a behind the scenes of it and just how tight the room, because they're filming in basically an actual car, how tight everything is means like there's a character who's on screen like screaming like, "Oh my God, oh my God." But then for the camera to get where it needs to get, that person has to like lean back, you know, in their chair and like then like crouch
like
in
one
a corner.
Where they have to, like, duck down or something.
Yeah. Like, and yeah, just thinking crazy, about that for this movie, right? Where someone's like screaming at somebody, but then the camera has to come by and you probably, they had to like get up against the wall and like get out of the way. And just like picturing what it was like in the room for these like very prestigious actors in the, totally in the heat of the moment to sometimes have to like duck or move out of the way so that they could get the right shot and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That that's, you know, that's, to me, that is the magic. We come to this place to remember that actors like have to like use the bathroom and like duck out of the camera's angle sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all hidden. That's the magic of cinema, you know? And in these very tight like one room situations, the amount of just like weird stuff the actors probably had to do to make it work is probably like skyrocketed. And I'd be very, you know, it's fun to imagine.
Right. Yeah, this one's obviously, you know, it's a set.
Yeah.
But it's a set where we see all four walls.
Yeah, I mean, it's a set where we do, see all four walls at the same time. Well, we don't see all four, but we come close to it, right? Like, when we paint, when we're up in the corner doing a shot of the whole room with the men's room and everything on the other end, you're getting three out of four walls. And so, yeah, maybe that wall gets moved out to do that. But, yeah, most you're moving, like, they're moving, like, one wall out of the way at the time. Because most of the time, this location's tight enough. You can always see at least two walls. So even if they're moving the other walls out of the way, it's still quite, quite tight and restricted.
Right. Yeah. The technical aspects of the teleplay version are just even tighter.
Sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
There's a little bit on one of the bonus features talking about it where they cut to commercial on a zoom in of jury number eight's face with a tracking shot following him down the table. And then when it comes back from commercial, we're on the same shot and pan back down the table as he walks back to his seat. But to do that for live television meant he had to be in the exact same position he was in 2 minutes ago when the commercial started.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone had to be close enough to where they should have
obviously,
been.
Obviously, you know, the audience isn't going to necessarily remember exactly what the scene looked like, but it's got to be close enough that you're not going to like blow anybody's mind and be like, where did juror number seven go? Did they disappear? Like, or whatever, you know, like, presumably, I have to assume that set has three walls. I'm sure it's just mostly shot from one side with three walls, probably at the windows with nothing on the bailiff's side of the wall.
It's interesting. The missing wall in the teleplay is behind juror number one, and basically
that's such a long, interesting. Yeah. Wow, yeah. That seems harder than necessary, but okay.
Yeah, it's mostly that length. It is very interesting.
Well, I mean, I guess you can avoid having the backs of like half the jurors to you. I guess that makes sense. It's just it's uncomfortable because you have to very much go like fucking Da Vinci's Last Supper bullshit on it. Like, why is everybody sitting on the same side of the table?
Yeah. You know, for live television, it's also very interesting because there's a lot of, you know, in and out ducking of the cameras in and out. And that's hard to do when you're dealing with 1950s television cameras.
Yeah, when you're
cameras,
dealing
right?
with a thing that could crush a man and kill them.
The shooting of this one, of the film version, is not markedly different because it is Lumet's first feature film and he cut his teeth doing all that television work. But obviously they have a lot more time, right?
Like, in the which is probably him stretching a muscle that he's like wants, you know what I mean? Like, in the idea that, like, this is the one thing I can't do on TV very well. Is prolonged emotional close-ups.
You can with practice because the television cameras at the time have three lenses that they can swap. Yeah. You know, just rotate through. So, you know, he talks about having a mind for the fact that three cameras with three lenses, he's got access to nine lenses, and he's got to know which one's which and what to do with them. The film version takes 21 days to shoot. As opposed to the teleplay version, which is an hour.
Right.
They have 1 hour to do this.
I mean, it takes 3 weeks to produce, but it takes an hour to make the movie. I mean, that's what I'm saying is that you, like, more than anything, probably, you obviously get to, you know, do shots again if they're not acted exactly how you want them to be. You get to do things like prolong close-ups and like make sure that you can dot the I's and cross the T's a little bit more, right? Like you can make sure the sweat looks realistic and there's enough of it. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Got to get the sweat physics accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's very important in this movie.
Where most of the $330,000
was the sweat. Okay,
so it's all sweat effects. Like, yeah. I mean, legitimately though, like, I mean, the sweat plays a very, very important role in conveying lots of information to the audience about what the condition is, especially with juror number four, when he sweats for the first time. Yeah, who doesn't sweat, yeah. the stockbroker who...
The glasses guy.
I mean, like,
guy.
Right. It's impactful. Yeah. You're like, oh, shit, he's sweating. Like,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you also get, I don't know if this is on purpose, maybe it's just my own associations, these sort of like, you know, older, bigger guys who are just yelling their racist beliefs are always so, like, their shirts are soaked.
Yes, absolutely.
It gives the impression of, like, they're clinging on to these, like racist beliefs out of desperation, you know. Anyway, it does have a very compelling effect for me. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that Lumet had a tendency in his television work to use blacklisted writers at a time where they still had to work under assumed names. There is a little bit of that playing into here that certainly plays to this being a McCarthy film more than a general civil rights film. That is that George Voskovic, who plays juror number 11, the immigrant, the European watchmaker, had been born in Czechoslovakia and worked in radical theater in Czechoslovakia before he moved to the U.S. in 1939. And even though he began living in the U.S. in 39, in 1950, coming into the country, he was detained on suspicion of being a communist. That is, I don't think he ever ended up in the McCarthy hearings, but that is sort of the closest we get here. And of course, our immigrant character here gets the speech about being true to what it says on paper.
Right.
You know, we're here because all men are created equal, et cetera, et cetera. You know,
right.
He doesn't get quite that polemic even in it, but still. Giving him those words is something, at least. In the Friedkin version in 1997, that character is Edward James Olmos, and he's a Latino immigrant. Like I said, the 1997 version is much more upfront about the racial prejudice of what they're trying to do here, whereas this film still leaves it fairly ambiguous. But we are still at a time where Eastern European immigrants and Southern European immigrants are not as white.
Yeah, they've not been quite as fully
in the coming decades
into the white coalition in that way at that time, right? Like,
this is one of those films where I've got to respect it for what it was doing in its time, even though I know it could have been doing better in its time.
Well, yeah,
right?
I mean, absolutely. But, yeah. Like, it is popular fiction at its core, right? It is very, it's not rocking any boats to the point of being able to, like, you know, upset anybody.
But it is,
to not be able to make the movie.
It is tapping those boats.
Yeah, well, exactly. I guess, you know, if we extend the rocking the boat metaphor too far, right? Like, it is rocking the boat, but in a very gentle, leisurely way, as one might do on a quiet lake on a Sunday when you're out for a picnic or something. Like, just enough to be amusing without being dangerous, right? Like, to be
right. Well,
and I don't think that's the. I don't think that's the selling. I mean, it may be the selling point for some people, right? There's definitely probably a fairly large contingent of people for whom this, like, the sort of rah rah isn't the American system great thing works really well and is like an exciting extra element of the film.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think there are a lot of movies that are, you know, political in their nature and maybe in aspirations like this one that don't hold up, right? Because they're kind of even worse at this, you know, that like, I'm not trying to throw any movies into the bus, but like, I don't think people are going to in 60 years, look back at like Green Book, right. And be like, this is like, you know, a really important movie that everybody like must see, whatever. In addition to it just being extremely competent from acting and writing, direction, all of it is just so, it's just so well done. It also, the way that it approaches its political-ish subject matter is not like groan-inducing the way that stuff that gets made now, you know, sometimes is. So it has a lot going for it that it really sort of threads some fine lines, and you know, I think, really manages to still be something pretty incredible. Despite like it avoids maybe some of the worst pitfalls it could have had trying to portray something like this.
Well, it also just strikes me that you brought up like something like Green Book, and I don't know this for a fact, but isn't like it a kind of like running acknowledgement that like best picture films almost universally become like, in at least modern best picture films almost universally become completely forgotten because
the
way they're made at this point is so focused on winning an Oscar that like they don't play well like 5 years later.
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, this was a Best Picture nominee, I think, in 1958. So I'd be curious. Yeah, I'll just look it up now and see what won. The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Okay, The Bridge on the River Kwai is pretty fucking amazing. But that's the thing is, I don't think that rule about the Oscars applies that far back. I think it's mostly the last 10 to 15 years where it's like, oh, this thing has become such a strange sort of like football for studios to throw around to try to juice up sales and stuff that like at some point like they stop being films that people are going to remember 20-30 years from now. So
that's totally true, and I think that it's very related to what I was just saying, right, which is the way that without getting so far into rabbit holes, the way that Hollywood does its politics these days is like in some ways not that different from the way that Hollywood did its politics back then, but the sort of embeddedness of Hollywood politics with capitalism has like gotten a lot worse over time, right? And so any sort of what could be perceived as pushing back against the liberal capitalism kind of norms has gotten worse. The Hollywood's gotten worse at pushing back against that stuff. And this movie doesn't push that hard, but you're right. It pushes like a little bit and maybe in subtle
enough,
ways.
Right? Just enough, yeah.
And in subtle ways that movies aren't really doing as much these days, right? Like you can have movies that are ostensibly like anti-capitalism, where the message of them is like, if only we did capitalism in a better way, right? Whereas, you know, this movie isn't necessarily saying like, you know, we should do our system in a better way. It maybe is saying you should just like rethink in everyday life what prejudices you are bringing to the table.
Right.
And that, you know, that's timeless. That's going to outlast any evolutions in the way that Hollywood does politics stuff.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The hero of this film literally says, prejudice always obscures the truth. Right. And that is the point of this movie. Yeah. Right.
And it's gonna you're gonna be hard pressed to make the argument that that's like less true now than it was then. Even if it's a little milk toast, it certainly is true. You know,
Yeah. It's another way that this film version is aligned with the teleplay version is that this is a New York film. This is not a Hollywood production. You know, it's set in New York. It's filmed in New York. It is starring New York actors, New York stage actors. Who are maybe known, some of them, as character actors on television and film already. Fonda, of course, very much known at this point in his career. This is Fonda's almost an elder statesman at this point in his career, right? But yeah, it's and Lumet is a New York guy. You know, it's actually really interesting. Another project that Lumet and Rose did together was John Cassavetes' first acting gig. So, you know, that one might be interesting. It's about the dangerous youth and and why the youths of the 1950s in New York City are turning to crime. And Cassavetes plays one of the gang members, as I understand it. But yeah. So, you know, it's not a Hollywood production. And in so much of television work, California is an afterthought at this time, because television is a New York thing. And it's almost trying to pick a fight with Hollywood by giving California even live television is bad in California, because it's, you either have to wake up earlier or watch The Bad Prince.
Yeah, I mean that, and it's almost, you know, like I remember, like later on there was some other system that they cooked up that didn't require some of this stuff. It takes a long time before it's not just like a dude hopping on a plane with a fucking film reel and flying out to California.
Right.
Like literally couriering the whole fucking thing out there. It's just that.
Do you think this encouraged people to want to be juries, be on juries? Do you think?
I would bet so. I think it's a very favorable portrayal of how fun, you know, it's not not this interesting in general.
Right.
But yeah,
a lot of disillusioned jury members.
That's another question, Pat. I would be curious, like, you know, did this have a lasting impact on how jurors do their job? People in the work that, when I was a public defender, we talked a lot about like the CSI effect. Anyway, we didn't talk about it. I think prosecutors talked about it was like harder to convince juries of things because they would think that because of CSI technologies, you should just be able to like enhance any photograph, get DNA off of anything and all
that
stuff.
You know what I say? Good on CSI for making it a little bit harder for prosecutors to use mostly bullshit technology that doesn't
believe
work.
Me. This is not like, me complaining.
Fucking prosecutors and police technology, all of which is bunk. Like every fucking piece of it.
Yeah.
But they should have to work harder.
Exactly.
You know, I'm fine with that.
Somebody should go out and make another kind of CSI that is even more purposely aimed at making it harder.
Yeah.
Just like keep ramping it up.
But that really is so much of the argument in this narrative, though, isn't it? That the prosecution should have been able to say this or this and this, and the jury's one of the other problems with the jury in this, obviously, that would have gotten a mistrial is that so much of what they say is, well, they didn't tell us this. So why didn't they tell us this? And let's explore that.
Yeah.
Why didn't the defense mention that the woman wore glasses? That's actually another difference. An expansion in the film version is that in the teleplay version, she's wearing bifocals she's said to have been. Obviously, we don't see her because it's the same jury room, closed room. Mm. But she's said to have been wearing bifocals. And the fact that she wouldn't sleep with her glasses on is brought up, but not this idea that she was an older woman trying to look pristine and 10 years younger, and that whole misogynistic
right. Well, and that's also kind of an interesting
rabbit
thing,
hole
though,
in
this movie is like literally trying. That's just like a thing that's in there to add 10 minutes to the movie, right? And add another
dramatic point,
right? Like to add one more point of drama, because like in reality, the bifocal thing works fine, right? Like you can just deduce that idea of like as the, you know, have the jury deduce the idea that like, well, that doesn't make sense that she would have been able to see. But like here, like, well, that'll get it. That shit'll get us 10 more, 15 more minutes of this. We'll get this bad boy to 90 minutes. No problem.
Yeah. Like, right. You know, yeah.
Not that it doesn't work. It generally works quite well. I mean, obviously very misogynistic. They're also ageist and a bunch of other things. It's fantastic.
Yep. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, as Stephen alluded to and could speak at length about if we let him, I'm sure, none of this movie happens without the premise that the appointed defense attorney is bad.
Yeah, it's definitely a core thing in this movie, yes, that it's just repeated over and over that the defense attorney messing up and not presenting things is the reason that this kid's about to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's strange, you know, and like when that happens. So, yeah, whenever that gets mentioned, I think back to like my cases, and I did not do trial work. I did appellate work. And so I did a little bit of like, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking and stuff like that. But we had to always sort of remind ourselves, like, I had many cases where someone would write to me and say, my attorney didn't present this fact or this evidence. And I'd go talk to the attorney and I'd review the records and I'd be like, oh, if you presented that, you'd also have to bring in all this extra context that would make your client look even worse. Right. And so, and there's a moment where one of the other jurors says something like, well, of course, there are a lot of reasons why the defense attorney wouldn't bring this up because it would look bad in front of the jury or whatever. There's even a moment where someone mentions that. And that is exactly true. I mean, that's just exactly true. There's so many things that wouldn't get brought up because they would open the door to worse, more damning stuff. I don't believe in sending people to prison, let alone killing them. You know, I don't believe in any of that stuff. Right. But the fact of the matter is that the way that this case is put together, this is a loser case. This jury is wrong, and this person is definitely going to the chair in real life. Like, this is an absolute stinker of a case, and no change in defense strategy, unfortunately, would save this kid from these facts. And the only reason this kid is saved is because this is a fake movie that you know.
Right. Right.
Otherwise, this is a stinker of a case, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The amount of times where people were like, you know, the evidence is overwhelming, but what if? What if it's not? You know, it's like, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. But, you know, whatever it takes to save this kid from getting killed by the state, I'm down for, you know, so.
Right.
I support it.
Yeah, but, totally. Yeah. 100% agree. It's a fascinating thing to think about. Yeah. Like, and you know, that's again, that like, I don't know what it would have been like to watch this in 1957. I don't know what it would be like to watch this movie and not have the strange brain that I and the rest of us in this podcast have, relative to the rest of the United States. But like,
yeah,
you know, when I'm watching this, I'm kind of thinking like, you know, none of this seems believable. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I don't know if it's meant to read that way to the audience, that like, cause you know, when you're watching it, like, I think the first time I watched this on a plane and I was like, in my head, I was like, oh, this kid's fucking doomed.
Yeah.
It's over. Is this is doomed?
I do wonder within the movie if like the writers, you know, in the fiction of the movie, does the universe of the movie believe that this kid's actually innocent, or does the universe of this movie really think this kid probably is guilty, but the core principles of the system require to ask these hard questions, stand up for what you believe in. And I also think there's like a third option, which is like the guilt or innocence of the kid is not as important as what his predicament forces these men to confront about themselves and what they believe. And so actually the kid's sort of guilt or innocence is not as important.
It's not really relevant, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that's the trap you can sort of find yourself in if you're thinking like, oh, but this kid just seems so guilty, you know, and like these men came to the wrong conclusion at the end, but they got there because they all had to unpack their own relationship with their own children,
right?
Their own relationship to the communities where they grew up, you know, things like that. And to me, certainly more
apathy, like it's so. Just a general lack of caring at all from the one
right,
guy.
The baseball
like, yeah,
guy.
It was absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think, and that's probably what makes it so timeless. The thing we were talking about earlier is the fact that like, oh, this isn't really about a jury, a jury at all. It's about people being locked in a room and being forced to deal with each other. And like the biases and the prejudices that they all brought into the room, and like a jury room in that way works great as a like a locked chamber they have to
that's
be
right
it's as the like same way that a lot of like really good this. Single chamber detective dramas work really well, like, because it's not about like who killed who, like not really it's about like we force these people who have interesting personalities and interesting personal histories into a room where they have to deal with each other.
Right
yeah
and that's
what I was thinking I was going to say before. That's why the greatest version of the trial film is the Star Trek one, because then the rules don't even matter. They can just be made up.
Right. That's a good point.
Every time Star Trek does a trial by jury, like a one, they almost every series has one. it's always like, yeah, but guess what? We made up the rules too. Motherfucker, we can do anything we want. This is just a Battlestar Galactica rule to make this work.
Yeah, yeah, Battlestar Galactica had a really good thing. Fake trial episode.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Any sci-fi one where you can just make up whatever the fuck you want is perfect for it, because then you can like, you can even add drama by creating a rule that makes no goddamn sense.
That's right.
any Klingon trial is the best, because it's
the
rules are just like, it's like, they're not even consistent across series. It's like, oh yeah, the Klingon legal system changed over the last 200 years. Now,
sure,
this is a rule.
Of course. A wizard did it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's beautiful. Right. Assuming that they had them in fantasy novels, it would work the same way. It's just like, for some reason, the fantasy genre has never gotten into the idea that like legal dramas.
Fantasy legal dramas. Yeah.
You joke about these changes, but Pat already established that Japan only started doing jury trials within the last decade.
Like, obviously, it's a thing that's in flux all the time. We could get into it. It was a fascinating development, because there was a lot of serious, and still is a lot of serious, concern about the trauma caused to the jury for being responsible for these things. Like, the idea that the panel of judges are trained people who are meant to do this as a job and accept that as a part of their livelihood is quite a different idea than the idea that, like, it's 10 in Japan, but like that, like, 10 random people are going to be responsible for making judgments about the life of another person and what that trauma might be. If they find them guilty, like, you know, will they be traumatized by the fact that that person is going to be hanged? Will they be traumatized by the things they're shown in court? Like,
certainly,
what are we
going to
do for those people when they see something that hurts them? What are we going to do for them when it's done?
Yeah, certainly that is not a part of the American justice system. Yeah, that's
it's
very
just accepted as part of the culture, right? It is a huge point of discussion. When it happened, I was here, and it is still a point of contention every time it's a serious trial. Now, bear in mind, sending people to be hung is extremely rare. It is done only in cases of extreme wanton violence. Like, you have to be a multiple murderer to even be considered for that punishment. So people they're still deciding, like, life in prison, and they're still showing, like, dead bodies and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're very concerned about it.
This is a certainly darker aspect of the legal system than trauma on jury duties, but there is one time when this came up in American jurisprudence fairly recently. January of last year, the Oklahoma Attorney General proposed that maybe they shouldn't execute people once a month and instead go to once every other month for the mental health of the executioners.
Right.
I mean,
monthly executions was not enough time for them to mentally recover between executions.
I'm fascinated by the idea that every other month would be, but but like, legitimately, a big concern was like, well, you're going to show random normal people dead bodies, like, that were possibly, like, not through, like, accident, but were, like, purposely murdered, like, and it's not fake. Yeah. It's not a TV show. They know it's real. Like, what is that going to do to their psychological health? Like, what are we, like, so there's, like, lots of talks. Like, apparently, I think the conclusion is, like, they get, like, free psychological treatment after it's over. There's not a lot of murder trials in Japan, like, broadly speaking. But there's enough that, like, people have had to do it. And then they're like, okay, well, what are we going to do for them?
Yeah. Very interesting.
It's just not a thing, in America. But, it's a thing here.
Right.
You're American. You can handle a couple dead bodies. What are you worried about?
It's your duty. You have to. you're doing your civic duty by looking at these photographs. Oof.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember exactly how the layperson jury system here works, but because, like, obviously I read a bunch about it when it was instituted, and then, like, it's not super relevant to me because, like, I can't be called. It's not a thing that can happen.
Mm-hmm. You don't get to be the immigrant who
legal status within the framework of the Japanese government is unclear. Because the Supreme Court has ruled that within local community politics, I'm actually legally qualified to vote. Permanent residents are legal, but it's up to each municipality to institute that, and most of them haven't. So if I can vote, Could I also be called to jury duty? I don't know. It's very
They
don't call very many juries. I think jury duty's still maybe only for capital crimes.
I sure do. Crimes. I sure do occasionally forget how racist Japan is.
Oh yeah, I know. It's a whole thing. Like the Supreme Court ruled that a foreigner is a person by definition of the Constitution, and therefore should have the ability to participate as is guaranteed by the Constitution in the political ongoings of their community. And then, now mind you, they wouldn't did the United States either. Right. Like,
yeah.
Foreign people in the United States don't get to vote. The Supreme Court's like, well, that's what we decided. You guys fucking figure it out. And then the answer was,
oh.
And then a bunch of not much stuff happening. Some municipalities have made it legal and like let foreign residents vote. And some are like, we'll get to it someday. Sorry. That's a total non sequitur from what we're talking about.
It's not that total of a non sequitur, because we are talking about a film that is dealing with rights, but trying not to deal too much heavily, with rights.
Yeah, right? I don't want to get into that too deep, considering the lasting question that my family asked at the very beginning of the movie, which is like, wait a minute, where are all the women and black people? What's going on around here? There was a
12 angry men, something like, men only.
And I had to I just told him, like, look, this Welcome to America in 1957, like, you know, this is just what it is. Like, just enjoy the story, okay? Like, don't think too hard about it, because you will make yourself a little crazy if you do that.
Yeah. I was like, interestingly, the 1997 version is still 12 angry men, and it is still 12 men, even as a racial diversity is introduced. They do not introduce a gender diversity into.
I was thinking about this. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but you know, like there's I could not imagine a filmmaker putting a woman in that room, even one, maybe let alone a couple, without then making so much hay of like power dynamics between men and women. It would just be a other thing, you know? Anyway.
It would just be, that's all it would be about. That would be the whole movie.
It would kind of have to be.
Right.
Just because of the way that fair. Subject is treated. I would love a movie where there are just women in the room and they're treated like other people who just have other prejudices. But the way that, certainly in the 50s and maybe even today, I don't know that there are many filmmakers who would make a movie like that and not have the bulk of its runtime be about the women versus the men or whatever.
Well, I don't think anybody here has seen the 1997 version, but I can only imagine, given the way race politics works in the United States, what percentage of that version of the movie is just about the racial dynamics between the characters.
That's also true. I think that happens in these movies. It just sucks that this is the world we live in, where if you put like one black or Latino character on screen, you know, a lot of the interaction with them is going to be about the fact that they are of a different race. And that is true of putting one woman on a screen with a bunch of men. Most of the conversation is going to be about how they are a woman. And, you know, and that's not true of every movie, but it just seems like that's usually how it works. And it's boring.
Well, and movies don't don't do that are by their nature somewhat subversive, right? They are specifically subverting the way we understand race and gender in American like sort of society, right? Like, it's like a movie that doesn't do that is always noteworthy for the being a kind of movie that doesn't do that, right?
Yeah. So I have years ago seen the 1997 12 Angry Men, and I only remember that I've seen it because Jack Lemmon as juror number 8 is what pops into my head more than Fonda when I think about 12 Angry Men. A thing that I'm sure William Friedkin thought was very interesting when he did it, that plays to this conversation, is that juror number 10 is played by McKelty Williamson, who is portrayed in the movie as a member of the Nation of Islam and a black supremacist whose racist diatribe is against Hispanics outbreeding African Americans.
Boy, and again, yeah, they made some choices.
I bet William Friedkin. I bet William Friedkin thought he was doing something really great.
Yeah, very, very clever.
Yeah, but yeah. So again, certainly in other ways that you know I've already mentioned, that movie is much more interested in a racial politic, but it is also interested in a complicated racial politic that is maybe too much for but William Friedkin's gonna be William Friedkin. That just is what the man does sometimes.
I would be famous very asshole William Friedkin. See how it differs.
I suspect I would not make it all the way through the movie. Like, I can just tell you now, based on what's being described to me, at some point I would just get frustrated and tired and be like, fuck it, I'm done. I give up. I mean, well, I don't know. Who knows?
I suppose notably, while I did watch the teleplay version, I did not decide to watch the William Friedkin version before we discussed this.
Here's our chance, though, Adam. We finally found it. This is our excuse to watch To Live and Die in L.A. for this movie, for this podcast, as a bonus. I suggested it as a winter holiday thing because it technically takes place over New Year's. It doesn't really, other than telling you it's December 24th one time, it doesn't really exist in that universe at all.
Add it to the list.
So your suggestion here is that rather than do To Live and Die in L.A. for a future Christmas list, we should instead
Just do a William Friedkin list. Yes, that's what I'm suggesting.
Based on watching the 1957 version of 12 Angry Men, yes, we should do a William Friedkin list.
Now, Adam, I want to ask you a question.
This is not more tenuous than anything I've come up with.
I have seen some of the shit you have come up with to explain what you have done. Is this worse in any way than any of the shit you have come up with?
It is not at all worse. That is fair.
Look, I did the job for you. You don't even have to hurt yourself like you usually do, where you tell me like in a text message, like, so Pat, here's the logical chain that I came up with to explain this month's.
It's like 10 paragraphs.
Exactly. It's like it seemingly cost him a lot of mental pain. Actually, to be fair, most of the time it's the opposite in the sense that like you excluded things based on some rule you invented for yourself.
Right.
That doesn't exist because you make all the rules. It's a fucking Klingon trial. You can do whatever the fuck you want.
I was going to say That's true.
Yeah. The problem with a Friedkin list, though, Pat, is that we'd end up watching The Exorcist, and I know you don't want to watch The Exorcist.
I've seen The Exorcist, so. But...
Oh, wait. Actually, The Exorcist might be in the Criterion Collection, now that I think
about it. Adam, a thing that you've discovered about me over the years is I've seen a stupid amount of horror movies for somebody who does not like horror movies.
That's fair.
Mainly because I do like movies. And I hung out with people who liked movies when I was younger, which was a mistake. Serious mistake. Because university-age people who like movies have bad taste, by and large. But nonetheless. We can watch it. We'll end up watching The French Connection. And we can talk about the thing that is apparently a myth. That, like, gets espoused. We talked about it before. We've talked about... In The French Connection, like, the chase scene, like, was shot on real streets, but then it's actually not real.
Oh, yeah.
The myth inside the myth, it's, like, really...
I see.
We've talked about that before.
Anyway, let's step away from William
Friedkin. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Totally. I'm doing it even worse than I was before.
Yeah. Well, friends, I think we've probably talked about 12 Angry Men enough. thank you, Stephen, so much for joining us this week. Always a pleasure to have you on, and I wish timing had worked out that you could have been on the Three Colors trilogy as well, but I'm glad to have gotten you for this.
Yeah, very happy to be here. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah,
thank you so much. It was really a lot of fun to have you. This was great.
Next week, big treat. We do get another Lubitsch film, Design for Living, from 1933 is our next film. So look forward to that. But this week we've been talking 12 Angry Men from 1957, directly by Sidney Lumet, as well as a little talk about other versions of it as well. Thank you so much for listening to Lost in Criterion. I'm, as always, Leon Glass. With me, as always, John Patrick Ovitari Dorgan. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Lost in Criterion with co-hosts Lee Adam Glass and John Patrick Owatari Dorgan. With the collapse of Twitter, who knows what social media we might end up at. How about Blue Sky? That sounds great. Check out the official podcast account at lostincriterion.bsky.social. Jonathan Hape does our music, and you can check out more of his work at jonathan-hape.com or on any music streaming service. And you probably should. He's pretty good. A big thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. You can join their ranks at patreon.com/lostincriterion. And hey, thank you for listening.